Wanted, I failed to introduce Jay properly this morning. I think my brain just went and locked out or something. But we are very excited to have Dr. Jay Smith this morning. He is the founder of the Fander Center for Apologetics in London, England. Do we add polemics to that on the title now? probably could, right? Jay and Judy have been working to evangelize Muslims in England and in Senegal and in France and many other places in the world where you've been called to speak and share and debate. And since 1995, he has participated in more than 80 formal debates with distinguished Muslim scholars and statesmen and apologists all over the world. And if you ever get a chance to experience that, to go and sit in and be present during one of those debates, it's an amazing thing and a wonderful thing. And you can do that online. You can do that on YouTube, right? There are debates there, but there's also a lot of video from one of the other things that they like to do, and that is that they're spending time in Hyde Park at Speaker's Corner, not only defending the faith, but just really getting in there and attacking and showing, here's where the holes are, and here's what the gospel says. And I was sharing with Jay earlier that when I was about 13, my uncle took me to Speaker's Corner and just to see the action, to see what was going on. And it's always stuck in my head, you know, all these wild people calling at each other and all this kind of stuff. So I'm going to ask Jay to come on up, and I've asked him if he would share a little bit about that, about what it's like to be at Speaker's Corner as well.
Turn on your mic. Good. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You can hear me at the back? No, I'm not hearing any yes or no. Yeah. We'll just go ahead and assume you can. Terrific. Well, listen, you did want to ask me about Speaker's Corner. Have anybody been to Speaker's Corner? One, two, three, four. Anybody seen us at Speaker's Corner? Oh, you have. Okay. All of you. Terrific. Speaker's Corner is an institution that is unique in the world. It is the only one like it. There's a good reason why. It could only exist in England. It could not exist here in the United States. You have too many guns. It's the only place on earth where you can say anything you want. There are no rules. You can deny the Holocaust there. You can say anything. Hold on. There are two rules. One is you may not slag off the Queen. And secondly, you may not use any violence. Now, both are broken every week. But it is the one place, it is where they used to execute all the prisoners. Back in the last few centuries, they would execute them right there at Hyde Park, and always on a Sunday, so it only exists on Sundays. And before the prisoners would be executed, they would be given one last defense. And so they'd get up on a soapbox. That's why that term, get off your soapbox, that's where that comes from, Speaker's Corner. And they would get on the soapbox, and they would try to give their last defense, which always failed because they always got executed. But because the thousands of people were all down there to watch these executions, that was the entertainment back then. They would come on Sundays just to watch the executions. The crowds were already there, so people would get up on the box, and they would continue to preach and speak. And that's where the political analysts would get up there, and that's where the politicians would do their give their platform. And that's where, of course, many Christians went. Men like Soper and others, famous Christians, would go and try their trade. And it's the best place to learn your trade. It was the best place for me to learn how to speak. I had homiletics in seminary, but nothing like Speaker's Corner. Because at least when you do homiletics, people listen to you, and they sit there and either nod their head. They may do it this way, but they don't say anything more. At Speaker's Corner, you can heckle, and it is the place to heckle. And we have professional hecklers. They're called codgers. That's where the word old codger comes from. It comes from Speaker's Corner. So we would get there, and I moved down there in 1992 when I first arrived in London. That's where I used to go every Sunday. And I was overwhelmed by what I saw there. I was not prepared at all for what was to hit us. Because at Speaker's Corner, the Muslims had taken over the corner. They dominated the corner. And there would be about 10 ladders. Now, when I say ladders, they're just these little kitchen ladders that you have in your kitchens, just two steps up. Just so your head's above the crowd so you can be seen. That's all you need is one little ladder. You don't want to get a tall ladder because, remember, the higher you are, the greater you fall when you get thrown off. And we get thrown off all the time. And back in the 1990s, it was very violent down at Speaker's Corner. Lots of violence. And we would get up. I was not on a ladder to begin with. I was always on the ground. And I saw about 10 different ladders, Muslim speakers. And around every speaker was a whole horde of talibes. These would be disciples. Every speaker would come with his school of disciples. And I would try to get into the crowds. In the afternoons, the Muslims completely controlled it. In the mornings, you would have the Christians that were there. Then you'd have the homosexuals would come. Then the Nation of Islam would come. And then your liberationists would come. By about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, all the homosexuals left, all the Christians left, and all the liberationists, because then the Muslims came. And once the Muslims came, you didn't want to be around. And they just controlled the entire corner. So I would always make sure I was there at 3 o'clock to take them on at when they were at their greatest. But I was just one of about 4 of us. But the other 3 knew nothing about Islam. I thought I knew everything. I already had 2 master's degrees, one in Islamics and one in apologetics. So I thought I was the biggest man on earth. I knew I could take on anybody. I knew there was not a chink in my armor until the first day I went to Speaker's Corner. Boy, did I get humiliated. They ran circles around me. And I caught back battered. I remember talking to Judy. I don't want to ever go down there again. Judy kicked me out the next day and says, "You're going right back down. Get back up on the horse again." And she was the one that kept pushing me down to go to Speaker's Corner. Because she said, if you want to learn your craft, the best place on earth is Speaker's Corner. Bar none. Because you get an immediate response. Immediate response. The other thing about Speaker's Corner, John, is it fits the Muslim mindset. See, most Muslims come from oral cultures. They don't come from literate cultures like we do. Most Muslims I know, from the Middle East, from India, from North Africa, when they learn something, they learn it by hearing it. Their theology comes by hearing it in the khutbah on a Friday afternoon in the mosque. And they memorize what they learn. They memorize the Quran. They don't read the Quran, they memorize it in a language which most of them don't even understand. So everything is oral. That's why they're so quick at names, dates, places, and events. They can pick up much things much quicker than we can because we're dependent on a book. And we'd have all our evangelism is based on books, is it not? You give out books, you give out tracts. We're hopeless at oratory. We don't know what it's like to be an orator. And I remember this is written, really came to my, what really brought this to home to me was when I was in France with Judy. Judy and I were learning French because we were being sent out to Senegal, which is a French-speaking colony, and is also a place where they speak Wolof. So we had to learn 2 languages. No one wanted to learn 2 languages. That's why they sent us there, because we went where no one else went. And there as we are in Paris, trying to learn French in Alliance Française, and where the first thing you do when you walk into that class is French. That's all you hear is French. Boy, I was struggling. And what we would do in that class is they would take on a theme per day to argue. That's all we would do. We would argue in our broken French. And it soon became quite apparent that the man that argued with me against everybody else was a Muslim. And he was a deist. He was on his way to Morocco. He was a Turkish Muslim learning French. So he could do what I did in Morocco. I was going to do what he did in Senegal. We both had to learn French, but we were miserable at it. Nonetheless, we agreed upon everything except Jesus and except, of course, Revelation. But on everything else, we became very close together. And so we were arguing terrible because we were desecrating the French language. Nonetheless, we certainly made our point. And so he decided to take me to his mosque, and I decided to take him to my church. So we went to the central mosque there in Paris, which had an Algerian sheikh. And he started preaching in eloquent French. And there was Ishmael, my Turkish deist, sitting next to me. We could both speak English, but we could hardly ever even communicate in French. And suddenly I saw Ishmael start to close his eyes and going like this. And I looked at him, and then I noticed he started going like this. Ah, ah, alhamdulillahi, alhamdulillahi, bilisma. And he started going through, and he started, suddenly I started looking at him and said, "What are you doing, Ishmael?" He says, "Look at him." I said, "I am looking at him." "What are you saying?" "I don't know, but look at him." I said, "What's to look at?" The man's getting more impassioned. And as the man got more impassioned, so did Ishmael next to me. He got more impassioned. And I started getting worried for Ishmael over here. I said, "Ishmael, what are you doing?" "Oh, look at him, Mr. Smith." And I said, "I am. What's he saying?" "I don't know." I said, "He could be doing nursery rhymes. What are you doing?" And then I realized what was going on. The passion of the speaker was infecting my friend Ishmael over here. He was getting excited, not about what he said, but how he was saying it. It was the oratory that got him excited. And I realized we don't teach our young seminarians how to do this. Did you have that in seminary? In passion, impassioned speech? Well, I never had. In my homiletics, it was how to do 3 points and how to have an application and biblical reference for every one of those 3 points and then bring it to a conclusion. Nothing about passion. Nothing about oratory. And yet that's exactly what I saw. So I went to Speaker's Corner looking for this. And I saw it immediately. 10 speakers, hundreds of little crowds of talibes all around them. And I realized that I didn't know how to do what they were doing. They could really take on almost anybody on any subject at any time without any notes. You don't have any notes at Speaker's Corner. No books, no tablets, no computers. Everything had to be in your head. And I remember I started coming up and I tried to get into, sometimes I would get stamped on, I would get elbowed. Their best tactic is when you get into a crowd and they realize you're a Christian, they come around and they pinch you and then they look around as if nothing happened. And sometimes I would come home with bruises all over my stomach from there, just like a little bullies, you know, in a schoolyard. But then I realized the first day that I had no response to a lot of their questions. They were attacking my Bible. They had post-it notes all the way through my Bible with seeming contradictions and seeming errors to my Bible, many of which I'd never heard of before. And I realized I needed to retool. I needed to completely change everything I had been taught. I was going there to be peaceful and calm and nice and Christ-like. And they were battering me. It came to the point that in 1994, 2 years after I'd been down to Speaker's Corner, I was taking some courses at School of Oriental and African Studies, which is the school that teaches Islamics there in the University of London. And I was studying under Dr. Gerald Hotting, who's considered to be one of the world's authority on the history of Islam, but not the history as you heard it, not the history that you have heard in your schools and in your colleges, not the classical account that you're all told, that in 570 a man was born named Muhammad, and 610 he started receiving these revelations in a cave called the Hira Cave, and from 610 to 622 he continued receiving those revelations there in a place called Mecca. And then he moved to Medina in 622, and from 622 to 632, the last 10 years of his life, he then received the Medinan revelations. That's the first half of the Quran. And that after, during that time, he confronted the Jews, he finally got rid of all the Jews, and finally in 630, he walked into Mecca, took over Mecca, and in 632, he suddenly died. That's the narrative you've heard. And that's what you have been told is how Islam began, right? I just did it in a real skeleton in just about 20 seconds. That's the only narrative that's ever been taught, anywhere, at any place, at any time. Well, for the last 1,400 years. This Dr. Hotting was coming up with a whole new narrative. He said, hold on a minute. When we look at these references to a man named Muhammad living in a place called Mecca, we can't find any reference for this city called Mecca. Ooh, too. Yet this is supposed to be the oldest city in the history of mankind. The oldest city. It is where Adam and Eve were thrown down to. If you open up your Quran and you open up to chapter 7, verse 24, Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden and they're thrown down, in verse 24, to earth. Which means the Garden of Eden is up in space. I didn't know the Garden of Eden is in space. Did you know that? The Garden of Eden in the Bible is on earth, isn't it? God enters time and space. God comes down our direction, comes into the garden, and is walking and talking in the cool of the day. God comes our direction, takes on our form, and is able to walk and talk with us, was able to even relate to us face to face. But in the Quran, they've got that story in Surah 2, that's chapter 2, in chapter 7, and in chapter 20. In all three of those chapters, when you look at that story, suddenly it's a completely different story. This garden is way up in space. What's it doing way up there? And they're thrown out of there. According to the traditions, they're thrown down to Mecca. Well, Eve is thrown to Mecca. Adam is thrown to India. Now, look on a map. Look how far distant it is between Mecca and India. It's a few thousand miles. Suddenly, within 3 days, he meets Eve. How does he get from Mecca, from India, Chennai, which is on the southern part of India, all the way up to Arabia in 3 days? Boy, they must have had helicopters back then. Nonetheless, here's the story as we're now seeing it from the traditional account. So Mecca is a pretty important city, isn't it? It's the oldest city in the history of mankind, am I correct? In chapter 21 of the Quran, it says that Abraham is in Mecca. Hold on a minute, John. Did Abraham ever live in Mecca? Not that you know of. In fact, where did Abraham live? He lived way up in Ur, which is in southern Iraq, right? And he goes across all the way over to Israel, correct? That's 600 miles further north. What's he doing in Mecca? Well, see, here suddenly these flags started to go, and Dr. Hotting was saying, hold on a minute. If he was in Mecca, if he was going into the Kaaba and taking all the big idols and destroying all the smaller idols, according to tradition, there were 365 idols. He takes the big idol, destroys the smaller idols. The next morning when the people wake up, they see the idols destroyed. They confront Abraham and says, what have you done? He said, well, don't talk to me. Talk to the idol. They can't talk to the idol. So they take him and throw him into a fiery pit. Did Abraham ever get thrown into a fiery pit in your Bible? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Looks like they've confused the two stories, whoever they is. We'll come back to that. So here you have Abraham in Mecca. So in 1900 BC, it was a city. It was a pretty substantial city. Am I correct? Should have been. According to all the Islamic tradition, it was the center of trade, north, south, east, and west. That's why it became important. That's why Muhammad became so important. Because once he was in Mecca, of course, once he moved to Medina and then took over Mecca, that is where the sanctuary was. That is where the Kaaba, that square building you see that's shrouded in a big cloth, a black cloth, that everybody prays to all over the world. Back in 1994, I was hearing this and I started scratching my head. Because then Dr. Gerald Hotting said that there were two scholars in 1905, one named Fehervadi and another named Dr. Creswell, who had gone around to that part of the world and were digging in the earliest mosques. And they went to Kufa, which is just south of Baghdad, and they went to Wasat, which is just southeast of Baghdad, and they went to the original floor plans of those mosques that are still existing today. They're in ruins, but they dug down to the original floor plans of these mosques from the 7th century, and that they found the Qibla. Qibla is the direction of prayer. Every Muslim must pray towards one direction. When you go into a mosque, now the Qibla wall, the long wall, is the direction that Qibla, where the direction that they're supposed to pray. And everybody today prays towards Mecca. Am I correct? Yeah, just say yes. Yes, I'm correct. That's a hard one to get past you all. So there they went down. Creswell and Fehervadi found this Qibla wall. It was not facing Mecca. It should have been facing southwest, if it's from Iraq. Should have been facing this direction. It was facing directly west. Completely. So instead of facing this direction, it's facing this direction. They went over to Fustat, which is just outside of Cairo in Egypt. There they found another mosque called the Fustat Mosque, which is a garrison town, one of the earliest mosques from the 7th century. As they dug down through that, to the original floor plan of that mosque, they found the Qibla wall there. Now, it should be facing southeast. Mecca's here. It's facing straight east. So here you have one mosque on this side and not two mosques over on this side, both facing this direction, but they should have been facing this direction. What are they facing? I heard you say it. Go ahead. Tell it to everybody.
Jerusalem.
He's wrong. You would think it's Jerusalem, right? I thought it was Jerusalem. In fact, so did my professor thought it was Jerusalem. Because it looks like it's Jerusalem. I did a debate in 1998, and boy, did I get hanged. The Muslims took me to boot on that. You can go see the debate. Boy, I'm embarrassed. They say, Mr. Smith, you are absolutely wrong. It is not facing Jerusalem. They're 3 to 5 degrees up. It's not facing Mecca. That's the biggest point. Nonetheless, it's not facing Jerusalem. And boy, they hung me on that. And I was wrong, and I should have done my homework a little better. That was back in 1994. Boy, did I get hung on that. I had no idea that it was not Jerusalem. And there's a reason why it wasn't Jerusalem. It gets better yet. That was back in 1994. I decided to take this material down to Speaker's Corner. I was told also that at this time, Mecca didn't exist. A professor named Dr. Patricia Corona, this lady reads and writes 15 languages, all archaic languages. She's from Denmark. How many of you can read and write 15 languages? Wouldn't you love to be able to do that? Ooh la la. She got her doctorate at SOAS. She was head of department at Oxford University. And she asked this simple question. Why is it we can't find any reference to Mecca in any secular sources? So she decided to do a survey herself in 1985 to 1987. She took 2 years. She went to all the documents. She went to all the trading documents in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, up until the 7th century. No reference anywhere to a place called Mecca at all. She went to even trading documents from India, as far away as India, and Ctesiphon, which is way up in what is Baghdad today. She went to Eritrea, which is next to Ethiopia, looked at all the trading documents, read every one of these documents in their native tongue. She was one of the few in the world that could do that. And she wrote a book in 1987 called Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam. Read it and weep. Not if you're a Christian, but if you're a Muslim, you will weep. Because what she showed there is that there is no reference to any place called Mecca. Not the first, not the second, not the third, not the fourth, not the fifth century, not the sixth century, not the seventh century. The first reference she has been able to find for any place called Mecca is not till 741 A.D. That's the mid-8th century. Muhammad died in 632 A.D. Can you see a problem? That's a whole 100 years later. No reference to the greatest city in the history of mankind, where Adam and Eve were sent to, where Abraham built this great Kaaba. Now, what did she do? This is not a Christian polemic. She's not a Christian. But I saw this, and I said, hold on a minute. We've had the same problems. We've had the same things thrown at our Bible, have we not? Remember back, well, you probably don't remember. You're not that old. But back at the time when Wellhausen was living, remember him? Tübingen, remember that? Here he was, you studied him. Remember back there in Germany, and they were attacking the Bible, and they were attacking the person of Abraham. How could Abraham exist? There is no reference to a man called Abraham. How could Moses have written the first five books of Moses? Because no one could write in 1400 B.C. Abraham was living in 1900 B.C. Nothing existed that early. Therefore, it was all redacted back onto this man named Abraham. Remember, that's what you heard when you were in seminary. I'm sure it's what I grew up with, that you cannot prove the first 11 books of the Old Testament. Well, that is until they found the Nuzi tablets and the Mari tablets and the Ebla tablets. Three genre of tablets that have now been discovered from the same place that Abraham lived, from the Mesopotamian part of the world, the Euphrates Valley. And here they found these Nuzi tablets, which were written the same period that Abraham lived, in the same place that he came from. And suddenly we start finding names that are in the Genesis account about Abraham and customs that existed at that time that we find in the story of Abraham, customs that only existed at that time, such as that you could call your sister your wife, that you could, if you destroyed a cult god, it was a capital offense. This you find in the Abrahamic story. These come right out of the Mari and the Nuzi tablets, proving that whoever wrote the story of Abraham in the book, in the Pentateuch, had to either have been there, because all of those customs no longer existed after 1600 B.C. Moses, who was writing it, was living in 1400 B.C. He never went to Mesopotamia. He never lived in the Euphrates Valley. He would have never known about these customs. How did Moses get the right customs? How did he get them so accurately? God. That's why I love my Bible. I don't even have to answer it. I just say, God. Proof that that has to be inspired. They were looking for two cities called Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember that? They couldn't find these two cities anywhere. Herodotus, the great historian, who gives us the window into the whole Mesopotamian era, but he also is the one that tells us all about the... We have all about the Babylonians, all about the Persians. This is he's the historian you have to read, but he was writing in the 5th century. No reference anywhere in any of his writing to cities called Sodom and Gomorrah. And I remember when we were in seminary, this was a real problem. What are you going to do with Sodom and Gomorrah? If it's such a huge city, if it talks about that these were completely wiped off the face of the earth, someone should have written about them, and certainly there should be some reference to them. Well, the easy answer is they were destroyed. No wonder no one wrote about them. Herodotus was writing in the 5th century. There was no Sodom and Gomorrah in the 5th century. So that probably is the excuse for that. But this was always a legend. The story of Ur is a legend. This is what I've always grown up hearing. Until they came to a mound in the desert in Syria called a Tell. And as they started digging through the different layers, like you do as archaeologists, you dig down, dig down. As you dig down, you come across artifacts. As you look at the artifacts, you reproduce and recreate the history of the city. And they came to 2300 BC. That's 400 years before Abraham. They came in across an entire city called Ebla. Do you any of you remember this? Those of you who have white hair, like me. I remember as a little boy hearing about Ebla when it was discovered. It's good to be old sometimes because you can remember these things. They found this city, and in that city was a house, and in that house was one room. And on the floor of that one room were 17,000 of these little tablets. Tablets are brilliant because tablets don't disintegrate. They don't deteriorate. They're all written in cuneiform. So we can read that today. And they started looking around at these 17,000 tablets, and they came across one tablet. On the face of that one tablet, it referred to five cities: Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Zoar. Ooh, there it is. The first and only references to Sodom and Gomorrah anywhere in the world were found on one tablet written in 2300 BC. Proving that in 400 years before Abraham, these were well-known cities. But not after Abraham. No wonder Herodotus knew nothing about it. No wonder Thucydides knew nothing about it. They didn't exist at their time. But I get excited because take a look at the sequence of those five cities: Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Zoar. Have you ever heard those five before in that order? You would have if you read your Bible. Genesis chapter 14, verse 8. Look at Genesis chapter 14, verse 8, and see if you don't find the exact same five cities in the exact same order that we find in the Ebla tablets, proving that there's something significant about that order. And we now know what it is. This is a trade route that starts in Sodom, goes to Gomorrah, then goes up to Adma, comes down to Gomorrah, Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and then ends with Zoar. Ooh, I love it. But how did Moses know about this trade route? It didn't exist when he was living. There was no trade route in 1400 BC. It was destroyed in 1900 BC. But we only know about it because of the Ebla tablets written in 2300 BC. Ooh, don't you love your Bible? See, that's what God does. He just puts little pieces of stone into the earth, waiting for people to discover it. And if we're not going to talk about it, the stones are. It's the stones that tell us just how accurate our Bible is. That's the beauty. I could go on all day. I just went down to the Museum of the Bible. How many people have been down to the Museum of the Bible? Please go down. It's just down across. It's just across the border in Washington, just two blocks away from the Smithsonian. Go to floor number 4. Go to the 4th floor. In fact, what we'll do, let me tell you what's happened. You go into the 4th floor and you will see an entire museum that they have recreated of all the artifacts, major artifacts that support our Bible from the Old Testament. I think they've looked at our British Museum tour that we put together in London. I've done a whole museum tour, a 3-hour tour, of all the artifacts that the British stole and put to one building so we could look at it. God bless them for stealing it. But that's it just supports the book 1st and 2nd Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Samuel, the book of Genesis, much of the book of Daniel. It's amazing, all these artifacts like stelas and obelisks and tablets and murals, all supporting exactly the right man at the right place doing the right thing at the right time, showing how accurate our Bible was. Well, the Green family, the Hobby Lobby people, have recreated, looks like our museum tour. It's almost the exact same artifacts, all facsimiles, not originals like we have in the British Museum, but they put them into an order, but they haven't told you their significance. So I am right now in the process of writing up the entire tour so we can take your people down there. Give me about another month or two. We're going to take the Dillsburg Church first. They're going to be the first one. They're going to be our guinea pigs. And we're going to walk you through and show you the Moabite stone. We're going to show you the Taylor Prism. We're going to show you the Cyrus Prism cylinder. We're going to show you all these artifacts that place the right man at the right place doing the right thing at the right time, showing that there is not one artifact in the world, not one artifact that has been found so far that controverts a properly understood biblical statement. That's from Dr. Nelson Glick. He made that claim, and it has yet to be disproven. See, that's the beauty of our Bible. We could not reproduce every story in the Bible, but anything that touches history and every one of the artifacts we're going to show you at the Museum of the Bible are from outside the Bible. There's nothing to do with Judaism. There's nothing to do with Christianity. They're all from the Babylonian period, from the Assyrian period, and from the Persian period. But in every case, whenever the Bible makes a historical statement, which it's riddled with, it is accurate. No man could make that up. No man could be that accurate. Only God can. Now, we're taking that same type of criticism, and for the first time, we're applying it to Islam. Ooh, this makes my job so easy. See, we've never done this before. Gerald Hotting showed me how to do it back in 1994. 1994, I started taking this down to Speaker's Corner. And within 2 months, I got beaten up really bad. I got knocked unconscious. They had me down. I was told that 60 men started kicking me. I was out, so I don't remember about it. And when the police finally pulled me out of there, they said a big black man came and laid on top of me and took my blows for me. I don't know who he was. I never met him. A few years later, I was preaching at Speaker's Corner, and I was doing four debates, half-an-hour debates. These are not the kind of debates you're talking about, not the formal debates. These are what we call impromptu debates, where I go for 5 minutes, and then the Muslim goes for 5 minutes. We go back and forth, back and forth. They run out of material. After 50 minutes, we can go for 2 hours. And so we just destroy them with these kind of debates because that's, our material is so good. And after about 2 hours of doing this, I got off the ladder. And as I was walking away, a group of Middle Eastern young boys came up to me and just started punching me. They were just so angered after what they had seen. And suddenly, another big black man just came, put his arms around me, and walked me out. He said, "Let's go, Jay, let's go." Took the blows for me. When I turned around to thank him, he had disappeared. Who do you think that was? I call him Barry. He's my angel, Barry. A few years ago, I was down on the ladder, and I was there was a huge crowd there. I can't remember the subject of the day, but there was a Pakistani in the crowd who had come from, Canada, and he told Shabir Ali, he was a disciple of Shabir Ali, one of the debaters I've debated the most. I have done about 6 debates with him. He's considered to be the world's best debater, Muslim world. And he said, "Well, listen, since you're going to London, go down to Speaker's Corner on a Sunday while you're there and go and see my friend Jay Smith." So he came down to looking for me, and he was in the crowd. Afterwards, we went out to lunch, to dinner, and we were walking into the restaurant, and I noticed his hands were shaking like this. And he wouldn't look at me in the eyes. He wouldn't look up. He just looked, and he looked down. So I could see something was wrong with him. And so as we sat down, I turned to him. His name was Mubin. And I said, "Mubin, what's wrong? You seem very nervous." He says, "Well, didn't you see them?" I said, "Didn't I see what?" "The two men in the trees." Now, when you're down at Speaker's Corner, you have these big oak trees, branches that cover you to give you shade. And I said, "What two men in the trees?" He said, "You must have seen them, Mr. Smith." I said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about. Describe them to me." He said, "There were two men in the tree right above you. They were dressed in white, looking down at you and smiling." I started smiling when I realized what he was saying, and I turned to my colleagues and I said, "Mubin, let me tell you what you saw. When I get up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on that ladder to preach the gospel, to confront Islam, to take them on, over in America, which is 5 hours after me, about 11 o'clock in the morning, there are about 10 or 20 churches that are praying for me, and they're praying that I speak the gospel, they're praying that I confront Islam, and they're praying for my safety. You're seeing an answer to their prayers. Those are angels in that tree. I have never seen them. In 25 years, I've not seen an angel anywhere. I don't see angels. But God wanted you to see those angels so that you telling me this, because you have no index for this, if any Christian told me they saw an angel, I wouldn't believe them, because Christians are seeing angels everywhere, but not Muslims. Muslims don't see angels. God was saying to me, "I'm going to let Mubin tell you, these are two angels that are up there. Anytime you preach the gospel, I'm going to be protecting you." Which means I can go anywhere, say anything at any time, on any subject, as long as I'm bringing Christ into that subject, I'm going to be protected. And I call them Harry and Larry. So, Harry, Larry, and Barry's on the ground. I'm protected. I can go anywhere. Because God is protecting us. Back in 1994, I started hearing this material, and I realized that we need to do something with this material. Because we had not come across this material. And let me just give you, I see I'm running out of time, so let me just give you a capsule of what we have now found. With this new material that's now coming down the pike, and notice everything I'm going to say next has nothing to do with Christianity. I could be anybody saying this. This is as neutral as you can get. This is straight historical criticism. We can pretty well now say that this book, the Quran, did not come from Muhammad. We now know where this book comes from. We're doing manuscript evidence. We're now looking at the manuscripts. We, for the first time, we now we now have facsimiles of the six major mushafs. These are the six major manuscripts of this book. We now have the top copy in my computer. I have it. I now have the Samarkand. I now have the Husseini. I have the Petropolis manuscript. We now have the Sana manuscript. And we have the Mu'il manuscript. Those are the six major manuscripts that exist in Turkey, in Tashkent, in Cairo, in Petropolis, in Paris, in London, and in Sana, in Yemen. Those are the six major manuscripts. Every Muslim for 32 years, 37 years that I have been talking to Muslims have claimed that those manuscripts go back to the time of Uthman to the mid-7th century, that they are, every one of them is complete, and that not one of them has changed, that the book we have in our hand today is exactly like those manuscripts. We blew that out of the water in 2014. I did a debate with Dr. Shabir Ali in Toronto in 2014, September 29th. And you can go see the debate. Just go up online and put the classical debate, Jay Smith versus Shabir Ali. Look at the first 50 minutes. That's all you need to look at. He let me go first. He should never have let me go first. Because in that debate, there was only 700 people who watched that debate. Almost 500,000 people have now watched it since 2014. That's the beauty of YouTube. We can get this all over the world. And in that debate, I confronted not only those six manuscripts, I also showed that not one of them is from the 7th century. The earliest one is the Sana manuscript that's dated 705. The Top copy, which is the most famous, is dated 749. Not one of them is complete. Not one of those manuscripts agrees with each other. And not one of those manuscripts agrees to the Quran I have in my hand right here. Can't find any manuscript that agrees to the Quran I have in my hand right here. I turned to Shabir Ali and said, so therefore, when was this book written? When was this book canonized? When was this book finalized? I said in 1924. 94 years ago, this book was created. You don't find any manuscript that agrees with this book prior to 1924. Show me. You can't find it. And I said, where did this book come from? What manuscript did it come from? And he said it was the Hafs manuscript. The Hafs manuscript? Hafs was a student that died in 805. That's the 9th century. There were, we have now found 31 different students' manuscripts from the 9th century. We have now found 31 Arabic Qurans that exist in the world today. You can buy them in Jordan, you can buy them in Yemen, you can buy them in Morocco. We bought them in those three countries. And we now own all 31 of those manuscripts. Those Qurans, sorry, they're Qurans. They're just like here, written, printed. And we have found 59,000 variants between them. 59,000 differences between them. And these have been around for 1,000 years. All the clerics know this. The academics know it. Only the people on the street have never heard this. It is as human invented as you can get. Can you see what I've just done? I've just destroyed everything they've claimed about this book. They claim it's eternal. They claim it was sent down to a man for over 22 years. They claim that it was completed at the time of Uthman, and they claim it has never been changed. We're destroying all of those using as neutral evidence as you can get. So at the end of that debate, shaking his hand, I said to Shabir Ali, we've pretty much destroyed the Quran tonight. Next debate's on Muhammad. That was in 2014. We're now in 2018. He will not debate me again. Because he knows what we've now found about Muhammad. Guess what we found about Muhammad? We can't find any reference to this man's names in any Arab sources. You notice I'm saying Arab for a reason. We can't find any reference for this man's name in any Arab sources until 691. He died in 632. For 60 years, no one knew about him. Within Arabs, the Arab world. They never called themselves Muslims. There's no reference to people called Muslims or a place called Islam, or a religion called Islam. Muslims never called themselves that until 692. So what did they call themselves? Because they were conquering Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo by 650. These were under their control. They called themselves Saracens. They called themselves Maghreb, from the Maghreb. They called themselves Hagarines because of the line of Hagar. They called themselves Ishmaelites from the line of Ishmael. They called themselves Muhajirun, which means people of the Hijr, people of the Exodus. Nomadic. These are the names they give themselves. Nowhere is there any reference to people called Muslims. For 60 years after Muhammad, can't find it anywhere. Nowhere is there any religion called Islam for 60 years. Nowhere is there any book called the Quran. Ooh, this makes my job easy. And nowhere are there any mosques facing Mecca. This is the newest material that's just come down the pike. Dan Gibson, he's been working from 1979 to 2004, 25 years. He is the archaeologist. He has been going into every one of these mosques. He's found 65 mosques, archaic mosques, their buildings are nothing more than ruins today. And he's gone to every one of these mosques physically, which is what you should do if you're an archaeologist, right? You don't just read books. You don't get up on the internet. You actually go there physically. He's been there physically. He is the first one to go to every one of these mosques. He's the first one to find the Qibla wall on every one of these mosques. He is the first one to look and using GPS, but not just, he didn't use Google Maps. He did not use Google Maps like they have criticized him. He would never use Google Maps because it doesn't account for the curvature of the earth. He used GPS formations coming out of MIT. He got their coordinates, got coordinates for every Qibla. And guess what he has found? Every mosque in Jordan, in Syria, in Yemen, in China, Canton in China, thousands of miles away, in Chennai, in India, thousands of miles away, every mosque up until 706 is facing Petra. Petra? Hold on it. Has anybody here been to Petra? One, two, you've been to Petra. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Petra is where every mosque is facing. Take a look at your Quran. He says, look at the Quran. There are 65 geographical locations in this Quran. Look at every one of the geographical locations in this Quran. This Quran talks about a prophet, but it doesn't give him a name. Only four times will you find Muhammad's name in the Quran. Four times for the most important man in the history of mankind? Jesus' name is found 93 times. Why Muhammad only four times? But it always refers to this prophet. It just recalls him a prophet. From the place of the prophet, it doesn't give a name. Only once do you find the reference to Mecca. Even once, just once in the entire Quran. If this is the most important city in the history of mankind, why is it only referred to once? But it says where this place is, where this prophet is from, has a river going through it, has a parallel valley, has clay, loam, trees, has olive trees. Ooh, olive trees. There are no olive trees in Arabia. The only olive trees that exist anywhere in the world are around the Mediterranean. It says that 23 times that this prophet has relationship with people from Ud. That's Uz, as we have it in the Bible. 24 times it has relationship with people from Thamud. That is Nabatea, the Nabataeans. 7 times people from Midian. Those are the Midianites. The problem is, take a look where Uz, Nabatea, and Midian are. They're 600 miles further north. Unless he had a helicopter and went up and down every day 1,200 miles, there's no way you could have contact with them. But they all surround Petra. Petra has a valley, has a parallel valley, has stream going through it, it has cistern water, it has clay, loam, trees, it has olive trees. Everything you see in the Quran fits Petra. Proving that maybe the prophet in this book comes from Petra. Now take a look at the God of Islam, Allah. Who is Allah, the God? Well, it's just generic, means the God. We have a generic name for God in the Old Testament, Elohim, right? Generic, plural, three or more, Elohim. 2,000 times in the Old Testament, you'll find Elohim, pretty important. But that's not the most important name for God because it's just a title, the gods. What is the name that Moses needed before he went down to Egypt to bring back the Israelites? You remember that in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14? He wanted to know God's personal name. Give me your personal name so when I go down, they'll recognize what God I represent. And at that time, he gave him a personal name. And the name is?
I am
who I am in English. Yahweh in Hebrew. Ego eimi or ho'on in Greek. That's the name that he needed. He needed that name because that's the personal name for God. That's the God that doesn't just give a title. That is his personal name. That is his unique name. That's his eternal name.